Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Madiha Afzal about her new book, Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society, and the State. Madiha, who is a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, welcome to the show. I wonder if you could begin a little bit about telling us intellectually about yourself.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I have been working on doing research on Pakistan for more than a decade now. I was born and raised primarily in Pakistan, though I'd lived in the U.S. and in Canada growing up as well. When I came to the U.S. for my PhD, I started focusing on looking at elections and voter behavior and politician behavior in Pakistan. And right around the time that I actually started working as faculty at the University of Maryland in 2008, Pakistan was going through the beginnings of and a very violent part of the insurgency by the Pakistan Taliban against the state in the process of, as we know, over the next 10 years, but really over the next 7-8 years, more than 25,000 Pakistanis died in the process. And Pakistan really at that point came to be defined in terms of its struggle with extremism and terrorism. And so I knew that this is what I wanted to study, and it really and focus on understanding. I'm trained as an economist. So I actually did my PhD in economics focusing on development economics and political economy, but really using econometric tools and microeconomic theory to parse through election data outcomes in the Pakistani context. But looking at the topic of extremism is something that really required sort of a retooling of the approach. So it really required a much more interdisciplinary approach to studying it. But to begin with, I started looking at what the data could tell me about the topic, and so I really started looking at polling data and at attitudes towards extremist groups in Pakistan, and trying to relate it to, quantitatively to whatever I could measure: income, education, gender, and so started establishing a picture that was much more sort of quantitative, but interesting, and once I did that, you know, I realized that I needed to go into the field and really try to understand what was really driving attitudes, you know, what the attitudes were in the much broader sense than polling data, and what it was in the narratives and the education system in Pakistan's laws, et cetera, that was driving attitudes towards extremist groups in Pakistan. Because, what you saw at the time and what really was sort of befuddling was that while Pakistanis were being killed, it seemed with impunity by the state, by the way, because the state wasn't really engaging in any sort of decisive action against these terrorist groups. So, for instance, in 2009, it actually did put in place a peace deal with the Pakistan Taliban in the Swat Valley and allowed them to impose Sharia for a bit. And that's actually, the Swat Valley is incidentally exactly where Malala Yousafzai was shot 3 years later by the Pakistan Taliban, because she had actually written about that time when the Pakistan Taliban kind of held sway in the Swat Valley and were shutting down girls' schools and so on. But going back to sort of the topic at hand, essentially, the Pakistani state was letting these groups kind of operate with impunity, and Pakistani citizens had very confused narratives about these groups. And this is something that we'll go into. And so I really felt that this is something that needed explanation. And so, In some ways, in a long kind of drawn out process, you know, that combination of looking at quantitative data to understand the issue, plus going into the field, looking at narratives, seeing what was written in the media, and really doing some in-depth historical research is what led me to writing this book.
Sorry. No, certainly when one reads the book, it's very clear that it's based on a lot of factual polling data, and that's gives it a lot of strength. One of the things that struck me that in reading the book, and on the one hand, you do that, but on the other hand, sometimes I'm not sure that you do, and that is, you know, you have on the one hand the issue of terrorism or political violence and the attitudes towards that. And on the other hand, you have a society that's ultra-conservative to a large extent, and you do describe that in various ways, and that is, as such, not immune or not totally rejecting of militancy, or not necessarily violent militancy, but a very militant attitude towards the other, towards concepts of blasphemy, the way they perceive education, and so on.
Right. So that's a great point, because essentially in Pakistan, in some ways, you know, religion is inextricably tied. The dominance of religion, the centrality of religion, the focus on it is sort of inextricably tied with the struggle it has had with terrorism and extremism, and continues to have, especially with extremism. You know, terrorism has subsided in the country, partly because of sort of kinetic action that the Pakistani army finally took against the Pakistan Taliban. You know, there are still pockets of terrorism. The election that was just held in Pakistan last month was quite a violent one. So terrorism, though, has abated, but extremism still exists, and certainly it's tied in with its the focus on religion and its society and sort of the conservatism that comes with it. If you'd like, I can sort of parse through some of how it does so, or we can.
No, please do.
Okay. So you mentioned that Pakistani society is quite conservative, and you know, part of that, I would argue that the way it started in 1947, let's say, you know, at partition being conservative, was because of religion, sure, but also because of cultural reasons that are common between Pakistan and India. So you know, the rural areas where there might be tribal customs or sort of customs of patriarchy or sort of limited mobility and parda for women and so on, you know, sort of very conservative customs weren't necessarily born out of religion. Upon partition and actually leading up to partition, you know, Pakistan really had to, just sort of the Muslim League leading up to partition and Pakistan post 1947 really seized upon the idea of using Islam strategically in order to unite the country that at that point obviously was separated into two halves between West Pakistan and East Pakistan, which in 1971 seceded to form Bangladesh, but then also had very different ethnic identities within and ethnic and cultural identities within West Pakistan and then relative to East Pakistan. So the Pakistani state really used Islam, as I show in the book, it did so through the progressive sort of Islamization of its legal system, through its curricula, Islamizing its curricula, through giving into and giving sort of this platform to Islamist parties, in a way that it Islamized the population. So the population that was originally conservative has been Islamized from the top down, in many ways, though there has also been, again, through this sort of top-down influence, kind of a bottom-up Islamization in terms of madrasas that have flourished through, especially through Saudi funding that has come in from that started coming in, and Saudi influence that started coming in particular during the 1980s when Pakistan helped in the U.S. Soviet war in Afghanistan, and so in that the society has been Islamized to such a degree. Again, you know, the buck stops with the Pakistani state, which has not only allowed it to be Islamized, but has actively fostered this Islamization because it believes it benefits the nationalist purpose of the state, of keeping this country united and also keeping it permanently differentiated from India, which it believes poses the greatest of all threats to it and to its existence. The Islamization then of the citizenry has made it hard for them, and sort of the Islamization that has been extreme in some of its respects, right? And so and regressive in some of its respects. So, you know, you mentioned the blasphemy law, and I talk about the blasphemy law quite a bit in the book. So that's part of the sort of the progressive and in this case, you know, regressive Islamization of the legal system. You know, Pakistan put in place a blasphemy law which criminalizes offenses against the Quran and the Prophet and makes them punishable by imprisonment for life or death. And essentially, this blasphemy law in the country is thought of as a religious imperative, and the population really has internalized this. And what this has done is it makes it very hard for citizens to reject militant propaganda when militant groups also engage in sanctioning or, engage in violence against against, let's say, those considered blasphemous. So, Pakistan's most famous Kaval, Amjad Sabri, was killed a couple of years ago by terrorists who claimed that he had committed blasphemy by, singing the praises of the Prophet. And this is sort of Sufi music. He was engaging in religious devotion, but because it was considered blasphemous by terrorist groups, he was killed. And while he was very popular in Pakistan, you didn't see a large outcry against his killing, because when elements of Pakistan's own legal system that have have obviously been put in place by the state are invoked and can be invoked to target its own citizens, then its population doesn't really know what it can do or say. The other couple of aspects of this are thinking about the notion of jihad. The Pakistani army itself has used the notion of jihad to defend and to defend its fights against India, and also to encourage sort of this nationalism to sort of bring the citizenry on its side in the wars that it fought with India in 1965 and 1971. Its textbooks extol jihad, both as sort of the internal jihad, but talk about armed jihad. So again, when terrorist groups talk about engaging in jihad, it's no wonder that citizens are confused about how to deal with them. And I think the final aspect of how religion is tied in with this is that the very notion of why Pakistan was created. So, going back to 1947, Jinnah had, though he himself, there were, he fostered some confusion on the subject, and we can talk about that. One can argue that his vision of Pakistan was a state for Muslims, not necessarily an Islamic state. But others who were part of sort of the founding fathers of Pakistan, Allama Iqbal, for instance, had argued that Pakistan was the place to perfect an Islamic way of life. And so it should be an Islamic state. Very quickly after partition, it became clear that Pakistan was going to be on the path to becoming an Islamic state. Jinnah died in 1948, and 1949, the Objectives Resolution basically hailed Pakistan as an Islamic state, at which the Constitution of 1956 then firmed up. So that notion of Pakistan being an ideal kind of Islamic state is again something that terrorists use. So, the Pakistan Taliban, when it was engaging in this insurgency against the Pakistani state, would keep, very effectively arguing that the Pakistani state was not an ideal Islamic state, in fact, had no Islamic principles, and that the whole goal of the Pakistan Taliban was to implement Sharia and Islamic law in Pakistan. And the Pakistani state, because again, it wasn't able to differentiate what its purpose was, or it wasn't able to defend itself, wasn't able to extricate, its own narrative from sort of the grasp of militants. Again, the citizenry, you saw, and I saw in my interviews and saw this in narratives all over the country, that there was some sympathy for the idea that the Taliban only wants to implement Islamic law in the country.
A couple of things come to mind. One is, I mean, Pakistan's not the only Muslim state that has militants arguing that they are not really an Islamic state. Saudi Arabia would be another one. But what in a sense, and that makes the comparison interesting, what sets Pakistan apart, at least in my mind, is that it, together with Israel, is the only state that was created in which a primarily religious identity was given a national element to it. So you got a sort of religious nationalist development. And Israel obviously followed a very different course. And I guess the question there is whether or not in Israel you may have had stronger democratic institutions than you had in Pakistan, for one. But also, and you mentioned, you sort of referred to that with the reference to the military viewing warfare and defense of the country as jihad, and whether or not, in a sense, the breeding ground for militancy, not necessarily violence, but militancy as such, is not sort of woven into the fabric of the state almost from day one, and therefore also into significant segments of society.
Yeah, so that's a really important point. Yeah, and the comparison with Israel is exactly, you know, it's notable, and of course Pakistan, and perhaps even Israel would not. I'm sure both countries would not care to be
compared
and lumped together as likes, right? As like countries, but that comparison is exactly right. So the religious nationalism is and the nationalism derived from religion in this specific way is exactly analogous. On whether the sort of the notion of, you know, the country in some ways being ripe for militancy, whether it was not woven in from day one. I mean, in the book, what I've tried to argue is that in some ways we can trace what came to pass, right, retrospectively, exactly to how and why and sort of the manner in which Pakistan was created and how it's the first few years of the country unfolded, and in particular to the fact that it was this weaker of the two nations, you know, that came out of the Indian subcontinent post-colonial rule, and that weakness obviously led to the rise of its militancy. Its military, and the rise of its military has obviously the dominance of its military in the country, but the weakness of its military in comparison to India's, you know, larger, stronger military, and the fact that the Pakistani military lost the wars it fought with India, have led the military to rely on militant proxies like the Lashkar-e-Taiba, for instance, and then later on the Haqqani network as well to the west. But
the book tries to do exactly this. One can explain away sort of, you know, looking at
the two pillars that the Pakistani state was founded upon, and in some ways, in terms of its definition of itself, you know, the pillar of Islam and the anti-India element, and those two pillars and how everything was built upon them, and how the state responded to events such as the Soviet-Afghan war in the 1980s and post 2001, how the Pakistani state responded to events can be all be traced back to it, you know, relying on those two pillars. However, you know, while it can be rationalized in that way, I do think that it could have taken, I mean, it could, you know, one could also see a path that Pakistan could have devised where it rejected, especially if its democratic governments had more success, right? If its military had been in power, perhaps less, where it would have been able to reject some of those imperatives and not given into to militancy. So in some ways, you know, you're right in the sense that it can be rationalized back to 1947. And certainly that's what I argue. But one could imagine an alternative path that could have been plausible, where these outcomes that we see today do not exist, right? Or would not exist. In some ways, I think this goes back to your previous question as well, sort of. What Pakistan is struggling with right now is extremism that continues sort of unabated in the country. And in particular, you know, there's this fundamentalist group known as the Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, which argues for upholding Pakistan's blasphemy laws. Which actually ran in the 2018 election, and while it did not win any seats in the national parliament, in the national assembly, it amassed, you know, more than 2 million votes across the country, which says that, you know, groups like it, and this is a new group, you know, sort of extremist groups like it, though, you know, the links with violence may not be fully formed, hold resonance. These groups can then morph into militant groups. And, you know, there are certainly some elements of the Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan who have engaged in violence. A member of the Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan who shot at the Interior Minister Ehsan Iqbal earlier this year. You know, thankfully Ehsan Iqbal survived. But these kinds of groups, you know, these extremist groups that may then resort to violence, are something in some ways that is kind of a much more existential problem for Pakistan, and then militant groups that are waging an insurgency against the Pakistani state, such as the Pakistan Taliban, and, you know, and then we have, you know, we have sort of the Al Qaeda, Afghan Taliban on sort of on the western border, you know, Lashkar-e-Taiba working on the eastern border. Those groups can draw upon extremists for support, but those groups may not necessarily, you know, for the Lashkar-e-Taiba, we can certainly talk about this, but, you know, the Al Qaeda or the Afghan Taliban, I mean, those groups are not necessarily the creation in some, you know, of Pakistan, but those groups can then draw on the extremism in some ways that Pakistan has now kind of baked into its system, and that is really in some ways, the much harder problem to solve, and the kind of the slow, slippery slide that the country has seen.
I mean, sorry. Obviously, one can imagine a different course of development without question. My guess is, although that's easy to say in hindsight, that on probability, this was the way it was going to go. And the using of the proxies, I mean, that goes back almost to the beginning of the state, which really raises the question of, and you do demonstrate clearly in the book that when the violence affects Pakistan domestically, then Pakistanis turn against it, whereas if it's violence across the border or against blasphemists or whatever, then there's a greater degree of empathy. But nonetheless, it does raise, on the one hand, the question of if you're going to make a distinction between groups that engage in violence that you view as utilitarian or contributing and groups that don't, whether or not you can maintain that, whether that is sustainable. And granted, violence has gone down significantly in Pakistan in the last couple of years. But nonetheless, you do have significant incidents, as you saw in the election campaign in Balochistan, among other places. But the question is whether that's really sustainable or whether you don't get a backlash at some point. The other thing I think also, you know, which mitigates towards that it had to go this way, and it's also a difference with Israel, you know, the Israelis didn't have Saudi Arabia in the background. and that relationship and Saudi influence, you know, goes almost back to the earliest of days, with, you know, Maududi, Ala al-Maududi's relationship with Saudi Arabia and his role in setting up institutions in Saudi Arabia, as well as the Saudi role, including in getting Maududi off the death sentence after the 1953 anti-Ahmadi riots in Lahore, as well as in getting the constitutional amendment on the declaration of Ahmadis as non-Muslims. So you've had that significant influence, which was often religious, but also on the Saudi part geopolitically motivated. And so the question really is: yes, there was an alternative path, but was that really ever realistic?
Absolutely, right. So, you know, I argue, for instance, that if one is to point to a single ruler and a single time period that was the worst for Pakistan's history, that was Zia's time. But the foundation for Zia had been set by Bhutto, who was, you know, personally secular, but as you mentioned, you know, he was prime minister in 1974 when Ahmadis were in effect declared non-Muslim. You know, obviously Zia took this much further by, you know, declaring them non-Muslim by name as opposed to by sort of belief, which is what Bhutto had done, and then criminalizing them posing as Muslim. And then Zia was the one who put in place the blasphemy laws. But in some ways, the foundation had been set not only obviously by Bhutto, but by the constitution itself and the fact that the constitution had these clauses that focused on how to enable Muslims to live their lives according to Islam and how to not have any laws that were repugnant to or ran contrary to Islam. And that obviously had, you know, obviously the central point of the constitution is that Pakistan is an Islamic state. But had, you know, one can sort of point to sort of the quirks of history in some ways, you know, had it not been Zia who had taken power from Bhutto, who ousted Bhutto, perhaps, you know, Pakistan would be in a somewhat different place. And again, you know, why was Zia able to take power? Because of the dominance of, you know, there are structural reasons to that. It's not just one person, because it's because of the dominance of the Pakistani military. It's because Islamist parties were given this platform by Pakistan's democratic as well as military government to be able to, you know, run protest campaigns against and exert a lot of pressure on the Pakistani state. And of course, you know, Bhutto and to weaken in some ways the democratic governments, and Bhutto really stood weakened by this alliance of Islamist parties, the PNA in the 1970s, and so, you know, again, the situation was ripe for, in some ways, a military takeover. But going, you know, addressing a couple of your last two questions, you'd asked about whether or not it's sustainable. In some ways, the situation that Pakistan is currently in, whether or not it's sustainable, and in terms of sort of the reduced levels of violence, but, you know, extremism thriving, and then sort of this distinction that it has had over the last few years, which the Pakistani state, of course, denies, but it is apparent that it has this distinction, the distinction between good militants and bad militants, and, you know, good militants that serve a utilitarian purpose for the Pakistani state and bad militants that don't, are the ones that don't. And of course, these definitions are changing. But as long as any militants serve a purpose for the Pakistani state and extremism continues to thrive in the country, there will always be the potential for those militants using the population for violence, and then also the potential that they will turn against the Pakistani state, as they did with the Pakistan Taliban insurgency. You know, the Pakistan Taliban were initially considered good militants by the Pakistani state. You know, with generals calling them their, you know, our brothers, and then of course they turned against the Pakistani state and violently so, and now they are in the minds of the population as well as the state, the bad Taliban. So you know, this process can certainly repeat itself, and that is the real danger. You know, already we've seen groups like ISIS, for instance, recruiting from sectarian militants, the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, which existed long before the Pakistan Taliban did, and engaging in really violent terrorist attacks over the last few years. So the potential is always there. In some ways, it's sort of a cauldron that's bubbling, you're right, it's certainly there. I think you also mentioned Saudi Arabia. So I completely agree with your assessment in terms of Saudi influence, and that's what differentiates the Israeli case perhaps from Pakistan. I would argue that you know, that Pakistan's path can also not be separated from its relationship with the United States, and the sort of sentiments of its population towards the United States, you know, on balance, the population tends to be it wasn't always so, but now relatively anti-American. And in some ways, the attitudes towards, for instance, groups like Al-Qaeda, while Pakistanis will say that they reject violence, they'll say that they sympathize. And again, you know, this is obviously before, you know, some of these polls were actually undertaken when Al-Qaeda was a stronger force than it is today. But they would say that they do, while they reject Al-Qaeda's violence, they do sympathize with some of the ideology of Al-Qaeda. And so that is tied to Pakistan feeling victimized by the West, feeling used by the U.S. to help fight the Soviet-Afghan war in the 1980s and then be saddled, you know, this is one of the narratives that Pakistan has, be saddled with Afghan refugees that have exerted a great toll on the country post, you know, the Soviet retreat in 1989. And then again, you know, this post-2001, this narrative that Pakistan has helped the U.S. in the war on terror, only to be targeted with violence by the Pakistan Taliban insurgency. You know, that's a narrative that the Pakistani people have had, and you know, the argument people will make is that had Pakistan not sided with the U.S. In 2001. Of course, it really didn't have a choice, but people will make this argument that had Pakistan not sided with the U.S. in the war on terror, Pakistan would not have had this blowback by the Pakistani Taliban. And so I think it's inextricably, again, tied with sort of some geopolitical factors, in particular its relationship with the U.S. and with Saudi Arabia.
No, I agree with you on the relationship with the U.S. and the the strong Pakistani sentiment of having been used and then dropped and betrayed whenever it no longer was useful. And that relates, and I want to get to that in a second, in part also to, you know, where you extensively in the book talk about the education system. But before we get to the education system, two quick things. One is, yes, there is the relationship with the U.S., but what also strikes me, that goes back to the beginnings of our conversation, what also strikes me is that Pakistan, from very early on, there was a pan-Islamist element to its national identity. And it's, in some ways, it, unlike other Muslim states, almost saw itself on par with Saudi Arabia, minus the holy cities. And it was, you know, you saw that also in Pakistan, was one of the first Muslim states to lend support, military support, in the Bosnia War, for example. So it strikes me that pan-Islamist element is one that is not always recognized, but is significant. The other thing I noticed in your book, and you mentioned Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, and if I'm not incorrect, you only mention it once in the book, and you make no mention of, and I just wonder why, of, for example, Sipah-e-Sahaba and its later incarnations.
Yeah, so that's a good observation. I ultimately decided, and though sectarian violence has, you know, been something that has existed in Pakistan, you know, as I mentioned, much before this, the more recent round of terrorist and extremist violence, I ultimately decided not to, that it would perhaps detract from the focus of the book in explaining this current, you know, sort of and the current struggle that Pakistan has had, you know, post, you know, I would say 2007 onwards, post 2007 to in particular, you know, 2016, with extremism and terrorism of the particular kind that it had, but sort of the sectarian issues certainly exist in Pakistan and are tied to obviously the state, and while the state doesn't impose a particular version necessarily of Islam, right? So you know, the Pakistani state is not like Iran or Iraq or Saudi Arabia in that it doesn't impose a particular brand of Islam on its citizens. It is pretty clear that because it is a majority Sunni country, and that though you know, again, the fact is that Pakistan has had elected leaders who are Shias. That is not an like Bhutto, for instance. The Bhutto Zardaris are Shias. That is not something that is touted. That is not something that is talked about. So while sectarianism is something that stays on under wraps, you know, from sort of the top, there is kind of selective impunity for certain sectarian groups, and certainly, you know, Sunni sectarian groups have been able to take advantage of the fact that, you know, the state perhaps looks at them gives them more impunity than Shia sectarian groups. So there's that aspect of things. I think you mentioned a really good point, the pan-Islamist element, and that is something that really plays out in some ways in the Pakistani psyche, and in the book I try to bring that out by the fact that Pakistanis think that they are in sort of alliance with and in friendship with countries across the Muslim world, so Muslim countries, and that in some ways, and so you know the opposition to the West, for instance, they'll sort of some Pakistanis will frame it as, you know, the us versus them, the Islam versus the West argument. They'll also, you know, I saw this in attitudes towards terrorism, towards terrorist groups, where Pakistanis, you know, one popular sort of narrative, it blames the West and India, you know, notably both non-Muslim, for actually instigating terrorism in Pakistan, because they don't want Islam to survive, is what Pakistanis will say. They don't want Islam to survive, and because they don't want Islam to survive, they are attacking Pakistan. So kind of this mantle in some ways of Pakistan being an Islamic state is something that's very important. And the sense that, you know, when I was interviewing students, you know, I sort of asked them very... it's sort of an open-ended kind of question, you know, who do you think are Pakistan's friends? And they would say, you know, we think Muslim countries are Pakistan's friends, right? But of course, you know, that has its nuances. I got some, you know, Pakistanis have personal experience with the Gulf states, and some Pakistani And many Pakistanis sort of migrate at least temporarily to the Gulf states to send back remittances to their families. And so some Pakistanis have seen because of their personal experience, they have had this kind of they have a sorry I'm a little distracted because I there was a ping on my computer. I don't know if it came out in the recording.
Yeah, I did hear it, but don't worry about it.
Okay. I can start off from this point again so that we can edit that out. Okay, all right. And I've shut that application down, so hopefully that won't happen. So And so some Pakistanis, through their personal experience, actually have not very favorable views of Saudi Arabia. So that would be a very interesting thing to measure across the population. You know, what are views really like in the population for Saudi Arabia? And then the other interesting element is that, you know, when I asked, you know, who are Pakistan's friends, you know, us other than, you know, Muslim nations, they also said China. And that relationship goes sort of, you know, as Pakistan's leaders have repeatedly sort of drilled into its citizens, you know, it's a deep friendship. And, you know, it's notable that, you know, when students that I interviewed were saying, you know, Pakistan's sort of best friend is China, that China is obviously not a Muslim country. And they had just said in the sort of the previous kind of breath that Pakistan has is its friends, you know, its closest friends and allies are Muslim countries. So that's an interesting sort of fact of Pakistan's relationships with its, you know, with its neighbors, Muslim countries, and so on.
The sectarian issue obviously takes on added significance in Pakistan. One, because it borders on Iran. Two, because it has the largest Shia minority in the world. And obviously with the increased U.S. pressure and Saudi campaign against Iran puts Balochistan sort of in the bullseye. So in that sense, I mean, the sectarian issue is maybe far more important or has far more impact on geopolitically than it does in other countries. I want to move on to the education part of your book, in which that goes back to, I think, you know, what I described as being woven into the DNA of the country. You know, if I were to summarize what you were saying is that a lot of the attitudes that we're talking about are built into the education system, whether or not that is the public education system or the government-run education system, or whether that is madrasas, religious seminaries, run by a very diverse range of groups. But the, you know, a lot of the basic attitudes, whether, you know, and obviously the state-run groups don't generate to that degree, or schools don't generate to that degree, people who are actually willing to go out and fight, whereas some of the madrasas do. You know, it would be good if you could talk about that a little bit. One other sub-remark on that is you discuss at length the whole question of how many madrasas are there and how many pupils are there. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you sort of come out on the side of the World Bank study that was done a number of years ago, which put the number much lower. You know, my sense is I've come to the conclusion that nobody knows. And that it, you know, you can talk to authoritative sources, whether they are in government or outside of government, and you will get vastly varying numbers. And so I'm not, I wouldn't take any of those numbers at face value. The other point, you know, you talk about the commission that they established, what now, 15, 16 years ago, for the voluntary registration of madrasas. And to me, that committee is a perfect example of the lack of sincerity in any of this. You know, beyond the fact that it's voluntary, as of last year, for all its existence, that committee has never had a budget. And if it doesn't have a budget, and it has no enforcement powers, then it really is a fig leaf.
Right. No, those are really, really, really important point. So let me sort of try to, talk about these one by one. I mean, in some ways, so, you know, as you pointed out, sort of the, you know, I really talk about the Pakistan Studies textbooks and sort of how they inculcate these notions of Pakistan being an Islamic state, Pakistan being under threat from India, Pakistan being a victim of the West, you know, the glorification of jihad, these biased views, and sort of encourage conspiracy theories and essentially create these sort of non-thinking citizens that are unable to sort of reject that reject militant propaganda, that can accept extremist propaganda because it fits in with the worldview that they have been taught in schools. But I think what I want to sort of emphasize there is the fact, you know, you mentioned that this was sort of built into the DNA, but the education system was not always like this. And in fact, in 1979, it was Zia again who actually issued an order basically saying that Pakistan studies textbooks need to be written in a way that essentially furthers the ultimate goal of Pakistan. And this is sort of a direct quote, you know, the creation of a completely Islamized state. And so these textbooks, for instance, you know, these Pakistan studies textbooks from public schools, you know, are entirely different from the textbooks, the way the textbooks looked in the 1960s and the 1970s. I showed the current textbooks to the generation that had actually gone to school in the 1960s, and they could not recognize them, right? So it's fascinating and others have actually also written about the fact, you know, people who actually did go to school in the 1960s, 70s have talked about this. You know, Pervez Hoodboy and A.H. Nayer had a paper come out in the mid 1980s when the Islamization, you know, of the textbooks was underway and talked about how they're now unrecognizable and so that, you know, in some, and the notion of the Pakistan ideology, and they talked about that at length, and I quote some of that in my book. That notion of the Pakistan ideology was something being Islam, and that is what sort of the central, you know, the first chapter in these Pakistan studies textbooks. And I should note here that the Pakistan studies course is a compulsory course for high school as well as college and even professional education. So for students studying to be engineers or doctors, they have to study these textbooks. So the notion of the Pakistan ideology being Islam, which is sort of where the textbooks begin from, this notion was something that was kind of cooked up and inserted in there with the help of the Jamaat-e-Islami party. So again, we go back to the idea that while, you know, perhaps this was inevitable, right, with the fact that the state was slowly Islamizing, and education is obviously a key avenue for inculcating that Islamization in its citizens. It did not occur until more than 30 years into Pakistan's creation that the textbooks were sort of changed in this drastic way. And now they're impossible to essentially change back. And so while Musharraf actually engaged in, at the same time as this sort of the registration of madrasas ordinance, and I'll talk about that in a second, you know, Musharraf also tried to engage in a curriculum reform for public school curricula, you know, basically because of various reasons, not the least of them being the fact that essentially now you have an entire bureaucracy that has been schooled in this education system. You know, there was enough pushback on the reform that in essence, what has been implemented is really a watered down version of what Musharraf had tried to, introduce. And essentially, you know, the key elements, the Pakistan ideology being Islam, et cetera, remain. And I think also notable is the fact that O-levels textbooks, which are in which Pakistan studies is a core subject, you know, really teach some of the same material in a markedly different way. And you see attitudes of O-level students who are taking these Cambridge board exams being very different from those students who went to the public schools. And obviously this could be selection, you know, their families are different. But the fact remains that those, you know, that these curricula affect attitudes, and these curricula are not the same for people, for students, you know, depending on which system they're in. And of course, you know, you also see that older Pakistanis have sort of better views on a whole host of dimensions relative to younger Pakistanis. And again, you know, one can point to the fact that the older Pakistanis have seen a different curriculum, you know, we see how tangible its effects are. On madrasas and on numbers of madrasas, there is a lot of careful analysis that has gone into those World Bank and academic studies of madrasa numbers, but the numbers are necessarily an underestimate because they talk about those madrasa students for whom attending a madrasa was their primary form of education. And there, you know, madrasas have students attend madrasas, part-time. And of course, the influence of madrasas is much more than enrollment in any case, because madrasa graduates go on to become Islamic studies teachers in schools, and madrasa graduates go on to become imams in mosques. And so their influence kind of permeates society far beyond their numbers, which, you know, again, if you take the Harvard study, the Harvard World Bank study, they are necessarily an underestimate. I think that's sort of the first point. And in some sense, the numbers are besides the point because of the fact that the madrasas that, you know, there are militant madrasas that still exist, you know. So even if it's a small number of madrasas, there are madrasas that are teaching sort of virulently militant material in the mainstream in the country, to the extent that those graduates can then go on and multiply, let's say, go on to become an Islamic studies teacher in a school, go on to become an imam in a mosque, go on to recruit students for militant activities. In some ways, even if there's only just one madrasa that's remaining, it's still a big problem. You know, the fact is that, and I talk about this in the book, the Darul Uloom Haqqaniya in Akora Khatak still exists in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. It's known to be and sort of an incubator for the Taliban. It still exists. It's still being given funding by the government by Imran Khan's government. He claimed that this was to regulate, and, you know, he claims, again, so the whole issue of madrasa education is a very charged one, and this again goes back to the fact that Islamists don't want any regulation of the madrasa system. They will argue that it is Western influence that is trying to impose Western values and Western education on Pakistan. And that's what they accused Musharraf of doing with the voluntary registration of madrasas. And they basically resisted it to the point at which the ordinance completely has become ineffective. Similarly, even now, the National Action Plan talks about the registration of madrasas and the regulation of madrasas. And Imran Khan talks about, he talks about something that other Pakistani politicians have also talked about sort of bringing madrasas into the mainstream. So having madrasas exist, but having them teach, regular math, science, and sort of regular sort of mainstream subjects in addition to their religious education. And that's what, you know, many Pakistani politicians have argued for. And it's arguably, at least according to the his party, in that vein that they allocated money to the Darul Uloom Haqqaniya. But you know, its ties to militants are undisputed. So one really wonders, you know, what the incentive was there. So madrasas are a really they have been an intractable issue again because of the fact that the Pakistani state is unable to control Islamist parties who will really loudly argue against any reform or regulation of madrasas. You know, in particular, somebody like Fazlur Rahman, who argues against this, you know, anytime the topic comes up. Fazlur Rahman wasn't even elected this time around. So, you know, he was rejected by Pakistani voters, yet still, you know, the state is unable to resist his the pressure that he and others put on it to let the madrasa issue be.
Right. I guess the question is whether it's unwilling or unable. Unfortunately, Madiha, we could go on for another hour, and I would love to, but the clock is ticking.
Yes, yes.
What I would like to ask you before we come to the end of this is, where do you go from here? What's your next project?
Yeah, so I'm doing a couple of things right now. One is actually now, in some ways, you know, the life cycle of research is fascinating. Now I've been working on some of the original work that I had actually started with when I started researching Pakistan on Pakistani politics and democracy and voter behavior and performance, because those issues have become really came very tangibly to the fore in this 2018 election. So issues of horse trading, issues of incumbency disadvantage, issues of, you know, how can politicians be incentivized to not provide patronage and actually engage in important the duties for which they are elected, which are legislative duties in parliament and so on. So sort of kind of a more political economy approach to the country. And then I think the second thing that I want to sort of focus on going forward is really taking some of the methods that I've used here in this book, looking at the links between education and extremism, looking at polling data and looking at kind of a more contextual historical narrative of various contexts to establish the roots of extremism beyond Pakistan. So in particular, thinking about the African context and thinking about, you know, the roots of the extremism in Nigeria, the Boko Haram case, and then looking at how we can really connect extremism to violent extremism. You know, what is it that links attitudes to actual violence? And so, again, trying to use an interdisciplinary approach to resolving that question.
Both of those are particularly relevant topics. Thank you very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.